7. The Destruction of Yamos. We soared at a lofty elevation, looking down on numberless miles of labyrinthian forest, on long, luxurious meadows, on voluptuously folded hills, on palatial buildings, and waters that were clear as the pristine lakes and rivers of Eden. It all seemed to quiver and pulsate like one living, effulgent, ethereal entity, and waves of radiant rapture passed from sun to sun in the splendor-crowned heaven. As we went on, I noticed again, after an interval, that partial dimming of the light, that somnolent, dreamy saddening of the colors, to be followed by another period of ecstatic brightening. The slow, tidal rhythm of this process appeared to correspond to the rising and falling of the flame, as Angarth had described it in his journal, and I suspected immediately that there was some connection. No sooner had I formulated this thought than I became aware that Angarth was speaking, and yet I am not sure whether he spoke, or whether his worded thought was perceptible to me through another sense than that of physical audition. At any rate, I was cognizant of his comment. "You are right. The waning and waxing of the fountain and its music is perceived in the inner dimension as a clouding and lightening of all visual images." Our flight began to swiften, and I realized that my companions were employing all their psychic energies in an effort to redouble our speed. The lands below us blurred to a cataract of streaming color, a sea of flowing luminosity, and we seemed to be hurtling onward like stars through the fiery air. The ecstasy of that endless soaring, the anxiety of that precipitate flight from an unknown doom, are incommunicable. But I shall never forget them, nor the state of ineffable communion and understanding that existed between the three of us. The memory of it all is housed in the deepest, most abiding cells of my brain. Others were flying beside and above and beneath us now in the fluctuating glory, pilgrims of hidden worlds and occult dimension, proceeding as we ourselves toward that other cosmos of which the inner sphere was the antechamber. These beings were strange and outré beyond belief in their corporeal forms and attributes, and yet I took no thought of their strangeness, but felt toward them the same conviction of fraternity that I felt toward Angarth and Ebonly. As we still went on, it appeared to me that my two companions were telling me many things, communicating, by what means I am not sure, much that they had learned in their new existence. With a grave urgency, as if, perhaps, the time for imparting this knowledge might well be brief. Ideas were expressed and conveyed which I could never have understood amid terrestrial circumstances, things that were inconceivable in terms of the five senses, or in abstract symbols of philosophic or mathematical thought, were made plain to me as the letters of the alphabet. Certain of these data, however, are roughly conveyable or suggestible in language. I was told of the gradual process of initiation into the life of the new dimension, of the powers gained by the neophyte during his term of adaptation, of the various recondite aesthetic joys experienced through a mingling and multiplying of all the perceptions, of the control acquired over natural forces and over matter itself, so that raiment could be woven and buildings reared solely through an act of volition. I learned also of the laws that would control our passage to the further cosmos, and the fact that such passage was difficult and dangerous for anyone who had not lived a certain length of time in the inner dimension. Likewise, I was told that no one could return to our present plane from the higher cosmos, even as no one could go backward through the flame into Yamos. Angarth and Ebonly had dwelt long enough in the inner dimension, they said, to be eligible for entrance to the worlds beyond, and they thought that I too could escape through their assistance, even though I had not yet fully developed the faculty of spatial equilibrium necessary to sustain those who dared the interspheric path and its dreadful subadjacent gulfs alone. There were boundless, unforeseeable realms, planet on planet, universe on universe, to which we might attain, and among those prodigies and marvels we could dwell or wander indefinitely. In these worlds, our brains would be attuned to the comprehension of vaster and higher scientific laws and states of entity beyond those of our present dimensional milieu. I have no idea of the duration of our flight, since, like everything else, my sense of time was completely altered and transfigured. Relatively speaking, we may have gone on for hours, but it seemed to me that we had crossed an area of that supernal terrain for whose transit many years or even centuries might well have been required. Even before we came within sight of it, a clear pictorial image of our destination had arisen in my mind, doubtless through some sort of thought transference. I seemed to envision a stupendous mountain range, with Alp upon celestial Alp, higher than the summer cumuli on Earth, and above them all the horn of an ultraviolet peak, whose head was enfolded in a hueless and spiral cloud, touched with the sense of invisible chromatic overtones that seemed to come down upon it from skies above the zenith. I knew that the way to the outer cosmos was hidden in the high cloud. On and on we soared, and at length the mountain range appeared on the far horizon, and I saw the paramount peak of ultraviolet with its dazzling crown of cumulus. Nearer still we came, till the strange voltes of cloud were almost above us, towering to the heavens, and vanishing among the varicolored suns. And we saw the gleaming forms of pilgrims who preceded us, as they entered the swirling folds. At this moment, the sky and the landscape had flamed again to their cumulating brightness. They burned with a thousand hues and lustres, so that the sudden, unlooked-for eclipse, which now occurred, was all the more complete and terrible. Before I was conscious of anything amiss, I seemed to hear a despairing cry from my friends, who must have felt the oncoming calamity through a subtler sense than any of which I was yet capable. Then, beyond the high and luminescent Alp of our destination, I saw the mounting of a wall of darkness, dreadful and instant, positive and palpable, that rose everywhere and toppled like some Atlantean wave upon the irised suns and the fiery-coloured vistas of the inner dimension. We hung irresolute in the shadowed air, powerless and hopeless before the impending catastrophe, and saw that the darkness had surrounded the entire world and was rushing upon us from all sides. It ate the heavens, blotted the outer suns, and the vast perspectives over which we had flown appeared to shrink and shrivel like a fire-blackened paper. We seemed to wait alone for one terrible instant, in a center of dwindling light, on which the cyclonian forces of night and destruction were impinging with torrential rapidity. The center shrank to a mere point, and then the darkness was upon us like an overwhelming maelstrom, like the falling and crashing of cyclopean walls. I seemed to go down with the wreck of shattered worlds in a roaring sea of vortical space and force, to descend into some infrastellar pit, some ultimate limbo to which the shards of forgotten suns and systems are flung. Then, after a measureless interval, there came the sensation of violent impact, as if I had fallen among these shards at the bottom of the universal night. I struggled back to consciousness with slow, prodigious effort, as if I were crushed beneath some irremovable weight, beneath the lightless and inert debris of galaxies. It seemed to require the labors of a titan to lift my lids, and my body and limbs were heavy, as if they had been turned into some denser element than human flesh, or had been subjugated to the gravity of a grosser planet than the Earth. My mental processes were benumbed and painful, and confused to the last degree. But at length I realized that I was lying in a riven and tilted pavement, among gigantic blocks of fallen stone. Above me, the light of a livid heaven came down among overturned and jagged walls that no longer supported their colossal dome. Close beside me, I saw a fuming pit from which a ragged rift extended through the floor, like the chasm wrought by an earthquake. I could not recognize my surroundings for a time, but at last, with a toilsome groping of thought, I understood that I was lying in the ruined temple of Yemos, and that the pit, whose gray and acrid vapors rose beside me, was that from which the fountain of singing flame had issued. It was a scene of stupendous havoc and devastation. The wrath that had been visited upon Yemos had left no wall nor pylon of the temple standing. I stared at the blighted heavens from an architectural ruin in which the remains of On and Angkor would have been mere rubble heaps. With Herculean effort, I turned my head away from the smoking pit, whose thin, sluggish fumes curled upward in phantasmal coils, where the green ardor of the flame had soared and sung. Not until then did I perceive my companions. Angarth, still insensible, was lying near at hand, and just beyond him I saw the pale, contorted face of Ebonly, whose lower limbs and body were pinned down by the rough and broken pediment of a fallen pillar. Striving, as in some eternal nightmare, to throw off the leadened, clinging weight of my inertia, and able to bestir myself only with the most painful slowness and laboriousness, I got to my feet and went over to Ebonly. Angarth, I saw at a glance, was uninjured and would presently regain consciousness. But Ebonly, crushed by the monolithic mass of stone, was dying swiftly, and even with the help of a dozen men, I could not have released him from his imprisonment, nor could I have done anything to palliate his agony. He tried to smile, with gallant and piteous courage, as I stooped above him.
"It's no use. I'm going in a moment," he whispered. "Goodbye, Hestane. And tell Angarth goodbye for me, too."
His tortured lips relaxed, his eyelids drooped, and his head fell back on the temple pavement. With an unreal, dreamlike horror, almost without emotion, I saw that he was dead. The exhaustion that still beset me was too profound to permit of thought or feeling. It was like the first reaction that follows the wakening from a drug debauch. My nerves were like burnt-out wires, my muscles dead and unresponsive as clay. My brain was ashen and gutted, as if a great fire had burned within it and gone out. Somehow, after an interval of whose length my memory is uncertain, I managed to revive Angarth, and he sat up dully and dazedly. When I told him that Ebonly was dead, my words appeared to make no impression upon him, and I wondered for a while if he understood. Finally, rousing himself a little with evident difficulty, he peered at the body of our friend, and seemed to realize, in some measure, the horror of the situation. But I think he would have remained there for hours, or perhaps for all time, in his utter despair and lassitude, if I had not taken the initiative. "Come," I said, with an attempt at firmness, "we must get out of this."
"Where to?" he queried dully. "The flame has failed at its source, and the inner dimension is no more. I wish I were dead like Ebonly. I might as well be, judging from the way I feel."
"We must find our way back to Crater Ridge," I said. "Surely we can do it, if the interdimensional portals have not been destroyed." Angarth did not seem to hear me. but he followed obediently when I took him by the hand, and began to seek an exit from the temple's heart, among the roofless halls and overturned columns. My recollections of our return are dim and confused, and full of the tediousness of some interminable delirium. I remember looking back at Eb Only, lying white and still beneath the massive pillar that would serve as his eternal monument, and I recall the mountainous ruin of the city, in which it seemed that we were the only living beings. It was a wilderness of chaotic stone, of fused, obsidian-like blocks, where streams of molten lava still ran in the mighty chasms, or poured like torrents down unfathomable pits that had opened in the ground. And I remember seeing, amid the wreckage, the charred bodies of those dark colossi who were the people of Yamos and the wardens of the flame. Like pygmies lost in some shattered fortalice of the giants, we stumbled onward, strangling in memphic and metallic vapors, reeling with weariness, dizzy with the heat that emanated everywhere to surge upon us in buffeting waves. The way was blocked by overthrown buildings, by toppled towers and battlements, over which we climbed precariously and toilsomely. And often we were compelled to divagate from our direct course by enormous rifts that seemed to cleave the foundations of the world. The moving towers of the wrathful outer lords had withdrawn. Their armies had disappeared on the plain beyond Yamos, when we staggered over the riven, shapeless, and sclerotic crags that had formed the city's ramparts. Before us was nothing but desolation, a fire-blackened and vapor-vaulted expanse in which no tree or blade of grass remained. Across this waste we found our way to the slope of violet grass above the plain, which had laid beyond the path of the invaders' bolts. There, the guiding monoliths, reared by a people of whom we were never to learn even the name, still looked down upon the fuming desert and the mounting rack of Yamos. And there, at length, we came once more to the grayish-green columns that were the gateway between the worlds.
This is the end of The City of the Singing Flame by Clark Ashton Smith. If you like listening to Clark Ashton Smith's works in audio form, look for more of them on the elricdark.com website. You may obtain a copy of The City of the Singing Flame in HTML format from www.eldritchdark.com. That is spelled ELDRITCHDARK.